Hi, everybody, and welcome to episode 2 of Volley Talk, PowerCore 360. We are going to talk about everything volleyball related on this podcast slash live stream every single week on Wednesday at 4 p.m. So make sure that you set your alarm so you can come every single week and dive into everything volleyball with us. So if you give me a second today, I'm just going to connect us to Instagram quick and we will be good to go. All right, awesome. We are now streaming everywhere. So hi, Instagram. I will reintroduce everything again. So this is PowerCore 360 Volley Talk episode 2. This is a podcast slash live stream that we go live every single week talking about all things volleyball related. This week specifically, we are going to be talking a lot about injuries as we have one of our guests here this week, Kelly Fiesler, who is a PT and also just a volleyball expert, you could say, and all things mechanics and everything. So I'll let Kelly introduce herself, but first we have our regular co-host here. I'm Darian Fiakuski, and then we also have Billy Glisson. So Billy, if you want to give yourself a little bit of an introduction, and then we will go to Kelly.
Hey, yeah, real quickly, Billy Glisson, founder of PowerCore 360, background undergrad in teaching, coaching, master's in exercise science. I'm a strength conditioning coach, and I guess I've been around volleyball 25 plus years.
Awesome. And Kelly, how about you, if you want to introduce yourself quick to everybody?
Sure. Hi, I'm Kelly Fiesler, and I'm a physical therapist with about 27 plus years of practice experience in orthopedic and sports medicine. My primary focus of practice has been biomechanics and returning athletes and just regular adult athletes as well as youth athletes to sport following injury.
Awesome. And so, like I said earlier, today we are really going to dive into all things injury on the volleyball side. One, how do injuries happen on the volleyball side? What mechanics are using that cause those injuries? And then also what to look for when you, or what to do when, if you're trying to avoid injury, I guess you could say. So we're going to dive into the shoulder, the back, and the knees today. So if you have any questions, audience, make sure to drop them below, especially if you have questions about maybe injuries that you have or aches and pains that you have, and we can kind of talk through all those things with you guys. So feel free to comment and we will make sure to respond to you. But if we don't have, oh, we just got one comment and it's just, I need your assistance. Okay, yes. Well, how can we help? So let's dive in right away today. We're going to start by talking about the shoulder injury in volleyball, which is definitely one of the most common injuries in volleyball that you will see across the board. But I'm going to hand this over to somebody that has a lot more knowledge than myself on this subject, which is both Kelly and Billy. But Kelly, first of all, we're going to talk about how a shoulder injury is created in volleyball. Could you talk to us a little bit about that? I think there's a couple different ways that can be created if you want to dive into maybe the first thing.
Sure. There's a couple different ways that athletes sustain shoulder injuries. One of the most common one in the volleyball world is honestly overuse. Today's youth athletes are playing all year round. They don't really get a break, and they take thousands of swings in a season without any true rest in between. I actually was reading an article today that talked about the number of swings they take in practice versus in a match. And it's like 60% more swings in practice leading up to their competition without any rest in between. So what happens is the athlete is swinging and swinging and swinging as hard as they can to create velocity on their ball. And over time, their muscles and tendons and ligaments that hold their shoulder together become fatigued, and then that creates some overuse injuries. The overuse injury also can lead to rotator cuff tendonitis, tendinopathies, due to one, the number of swings that they take, two, poor mechanics when they swing, and then just really poor stability, or it's kind of like a strength, but on a localized level of the shoulder joint can increase their risk of injury.
Yeah, absolutely. And so maybe let's dive into this a little bit further. So I know you talked, there's maybe like three different ways that injury can be created. There's the repetitive motion with poor mechanics, repetitive motion with bad mechanics, and then just like hypermobility in your shoulder. Can you maybe dive into each of those subjects a little bit more. Like what is the repetitive motion and why does that cause so much ache and pain on your shoulder? And then what mechanics are causing that pain as well, or making it worse if you have poor mechanics?
Well, interestingly enough, there has been so much research done on the throwing athlete, and not a lot of research done on a volleyball player, the overhead athlete, right? Volleyball attacking is very similar to throwing. The mechanics should be very similar, but there's not a lot of focus on the volleyball athlete. So mechanically, what happens is most volleyball athletes put their arm in a position as they jump into the air that increases the risk of all of the tissues, the muscles, the tendons, the ligaments to be in a compromised position as they go to attack the ball. Billy, I think that you would be great to speak to the fact that, you know, they constantly do research on a throwing athlete, but really, especially in the United States, not a lot of people apply those mechanics to the volleyball athlete.
Yeah, I mean, you just look at baseball, for example. They have pretty much, I want to say eliminated. That might not be completely true, but in terms of shoulder injuries, they've been at this. Dr. Job started stuff, 30, 40 years ago. Right. Shoulder exercises, baseball overhand throwers, pitchers, infielders, you know, they've pretty much eliminated shoulder issues. They have a lot of elbow issues now, right, with UCLs, but they've eliminated the shoulder side, and I think there's something to be said there from the volleyball world. Volleyball hitting is an overhand throwing, or it's an overhand hitting sport. The mechanics are not exactly the same, but really close. And so I think volleyball could learn a lot from what prior research. There's a ton of science. You know, I think it was 10 or 12 years ago, I went to, there's overhead throwing injuries. There's whole clinics now, Dr. Andrews, right? And other orthopedic surgeons and specialists and people that are out there. There's whole clinics now associated with preventing shoulder injuries in throwing, right? And the volleyball world, I'd love to think, and maybe we can be a part of that process, can help the volleyball industry or world catch up to that. So,
yeah, what's really interesting about that is I've had the fortunate experience of spending some time in Kentucky at an overhead athlete clinic. And one of the physicians, he's retired now, but he's in tons of literature about the shoulder, is Ben Kibler. And he talks a lot about the position of the shoulder blade and the position of the arm in relationship to the shoulder blade. And in volleyball, as it relates kind of to the baseball throw, in volleyball, most athletes are taught as they jump into the air to get a really high elbow right in the beginning of their arm swing, where really that position should come later in the arm swing, which would reduce the mechanical stressors or the tension and strain on the muscles and ligaments, tendons that hold our shoulder together. So from my perspective as a PT, that mechanical position that we're teaching across the United States more than European countries is really putting our athletes in a bad position. And then they're playing all year round, so there's never any opportunity for them to rest those tissues that hold their shoulder together.
Can I just butt in for a second? And Kelly, speak to, because obviously we do this at a lot of the clinics. You know, we bring the parents in, and I think a lot of the parents are shocked when we start talking about, you know, the high elbow and the setup. That's what we're talking about mechanically, that creates a lot of, just puts the shoulder in a bad position to be able to generate and tolerate the shoulder torque that's being created, right? But we ask, I think the thing that I'm trying to get to is when we talk to the parents and the athletes and talk about, hey, if an athlete was coming to you in the clinic as a physical therapist and you were trying to rule out shoulder impingement, what test would you do? What position would the shoulder be in? Speak to that, if you would, please.
Sure. There's, you know, different tests that we do to try to figure out which portion of the shoulder is involved. But one of the common ones is elevating that athlete's elbow in the air and then doing some rotation to see, when we do this motion, do we create any impingement, or, I hate to use the word pinching because that's a layman's term, but I'm going to use it, a little bit of pinching between the shoulder blade bone and the top of your arm bone, that head of your humerus. And when you put yourself in this position, you're actually decreasing the space that's available for that tissue to pass through as you raise your arm overhead. And right now, most kids are taught to, as they come up, to jump, to get up into the air, to get that elbow as high as they can, which I get it as a volleyball coach for in junior national volleyball for over 15 plus years. Yes, we want them to have a high contact, right? That's super important. But the contact doesn't come in the setup, as you would say, Billy. The contact comes after they go through the arm pattern to connect to the ball versus in the initial setup of the swing.
So, but just to make sure we don't gloss over this, the sure. position you just showed that you're doing a test with
yes.
is essentially the position most athletes, I would say 98% of all athletes, maybe more in the U.S., are being taught to swing with. They're actually putting their arm and shoulder in a position you would test it to make a positive diagnosis, if that's the right word, that they have an impingement. So we're putting yes. them in that position and saying, do you have pain? Well, if you have pain, it's a positive sign for what?
It's for a rotator cuff impingement, right?
Yeah.
Most of the time, it's either biceps tendon, supraspinatus are the two tendons that are mostly involved. But yeah, it's my go-to test position. If I have an athlete come in and tell me that they're having pain here down the side of their arm, which most kids think is their deltoid, it's not their deltoid. That's the problem. It's just a pain referral pattern for rotator cuff. Or just right behind the shoulder or the upper arm bone. That's another spot that when they're telling me they have pain there, that's an indicator of full stop for swinging.
Yeah. So I want to really drive home this point. This is so important to parents, athletes, and the coaches that are out there that are teaching to put the arm in that position. You're using it into as a positive test for an anterior impingement or impingement, if you would. Right. That's how they're teaching the athlete mechanically to put their shoulder in position. So, and I think it's really important. I'm going to backtrack here a second because Darian's being modest. Her introduction last week is she was a D1 hitter, and her freshman year is a collegiate Division I hitter. Darian, what happened to your shoulder?
Yeah, so after my first year of playing D1 volleyball as an outside hitter, I was an outside my entire career up till then. You could say I just had a little bit of aches and pains, right? Like, on the front side of my shoulder, couldn't really like lift it. Sometimes I'd be like, ice it, all better. Then you go to college and you're doing a lot more reps, right? Like your intensity, you're swinging a lot more and you're swinging year round. You don't really ever get that break. So after I played my freshman year, started, went through spring, played all spring. And then by the end of spring, going into my sophomore year season, by the first tournament of sophomore year season, I couldn't lift my shoulder anymore. And now it's still not even the most comfortable position for me to put myself in that position. My shoulder pops every time I lift it up. I can't load it back. So I just avoid it, basically. But it is something that I then had to stop playing outside. Luckily enough, I was good enough at back row that I could play libero, but a lot of people aren't as lucky. So yeah, that's what happened to me as a player in college very early on, which is a very common thing we see.
And I think it's a good segue to help understand that there's a lot of hitters that are playing in high school or club that can bang the ball right now. Mm-hmm. And they're like, I'm fine. I'm hitting the ball hard. I'm not really worried about my mechanics. And they're maybe having some shoulder pain. Kelly, should they be concerned with that? Or is that just like, it's no big deal? I mean, what's your thoughts?
Well, if you have a reoccurring pain, it's interesting. You know, you listen to young people, and I'm talking about, you know, youth athletes and even the early adult athlete who talks about how pain is normal. I'm hitting the ball hard. I should be feeling it. I should have pain. Well, pain is very different than soreness, and you shouldn't have pain, right? If you have pain, that's your body's indicator that something you're doing isn't right, whether it's volume, right? Whether it's volume plus poor mechanics, right? You have to identify, why are you having pain? Where is that coming from? Pain should not be normalized, right? And it really is in, unfortunately, in youth sports, it's become completely normalized for kids to play through legitimate pain. Soreness comes after, of course, you're going to be sore after a big volleyball tournament, 2 to 3 days playing all those matches. Muscle soreness is a normal thing. It usually comes a day after the event, might last for a couple days, but it typically shouldn't happen while you're actually doing, like, you're playing in your match. You shouldn't swing at a ball, whether it's attacking or serving, and be like, oh, that's my shoulder hurt. That's not normal. That is not normal. And you're really setting yourself up for a long-term issue for sure.
Yeah. Guys, I'm loving this conversation. We have a couple comments I want to show on the screen. The first is from Chloe on Instagram. She's asking us how to prevent knee injury. Chloe, we will get there later on in this live video. We'll be talking the rest of shoulder through, and then we will get to knee pain and soreness and injuries and everything like that. So comment what you're feeling in your knee, and maybe we can help talk through that with you. Another one I just want to put on our radars that we got a question for was, are abdominal tear injuries common for 14-year-old females at female athletes? And I think the comment also said something like they get it a lot from swinging and blocking. So we can talk through that maybe when we talk through the back injury is my thought. But those are just some great questions. If you guys are having, audience, if you guys have other questions that you guys want to ask us or add to the conversation, be sure to drop it in the chat and we will do our best to answer those. But going back to this conversation, so we've talked about how shoulder injury can occur, how to maybe tell that difference between pain in the shoulder and soreness. Kelly, can you show everybody, if you point out for anybody that is actually watching this live, if you're listening, sorry, maybe you can check it out on our Instagram or YouTube later. But Kelly, can you point out the spots where maybe you don't want to feel that pain in your shoulder?
Sure. If I have an athlete come to me and they're having pain, so we all have this little ball at the top of our arm bone, right? That's the head of the humerus. That's the top. That and your shoulder blade and your collarbone make up the shoulder joint, right? If you have pain right in the front of that ball, now if I pushed enough, it's sore on everyone because it's a bony prominence. And the more you poke, the more it's going to be sore. But if I am without poking and at rest or at contact of the ball, having pain here, right in that front side, if I turn and it's about right here in my deltoid or travels down the side of my arm, okay? And then on the back side, just behind the ball of my arm, if I have pain in there and it travels down into my arm at all, that local pain, like that pinpoint pain or the pain that travels, is a big indicator that the soft tissue is in trouble, whether that's a tendon or ligament, potentially labrum of the shoulder. We have to take a look at that and seriously determine what kind of risk is that athlete for further injury. I mean, I did a little bit of increased reading before we got on just to look at what are we seeing in the orthopedic world, and the injuries in youth athletes is just skyrocketing. Volleyball is what's interesting is that I saw is that volleyball being a truly non-contact sport, the number of injuries that they see are way greater than what you would expect from a non-contact sport. And that includes, you know, shoulder, knee, and back. And they just keep rising and rising and rising. And the age is getting younger and younger and younger where athletes first start to have their pain.
Yeah, that's definitely something that we don't want and why we are so passionate about injury and injury prevention and what mechanics you should be using when hitting the volleyball at PowerCore 360. So if you're here, please pay attention to this stuff. As a former volleyball player, please pay attention to this stuff use it when you are playing volleyball or attacking the ball. But I want to move now to, we've talked about the pain, the soreness, and how it can happen. But one thing we haven't talked about is maybe what you should be doing to not see some of the shoulder pain or try to avoid it the best you can. So Billy, do you want to maybe speak to how should you swing your arm that is safest for your shoulder?
Yeah, in simple layman's terms is if this is my shoulder line here, we call it the shoulder line, and this is my upper arm, the elbow needs to be slightly below the shoulder line. That's a position that the arm can rotate, create what we call shoulder torque. which is going to happen, right? We want to be able to create the torque for arm speed to get the ball hard, but we also got to be able to tolerate it. So if we can just literally look and say, here's the shoulder line, keep the elbow below that, which is dramatically different from up here, it just allows the shoulder to generate a lot of speed, a lot of torque, hit the ball hard, and tolerate it. So that's the simple definition. There's two things to do it, mechanics. So teach mechanics that will allow an athlete to use the whole body to rotate, use their hips, their legs, their butt, their core, their thighs, their arm and their shoulder. But when the arm's working, it's down below the shoulder line, right? And then there's a strength and conditioning component, right? I can have really good mechanics, but if I don't have strength and endurance and stability, I can still have pain. I can still have injury. So mechanics and strength, to me, are the two biggest things to really address.
Can I ask a question? Billy, when you talk about strength, I think there's sort of a misconception in the athlete world that, you know, if I have big, you know, strong looking biceps, deltoids, that I'm really going to be okay with my shoulder. When we're talking about strengths, strength for volleyball and mechanics, what are we talking about here? Are we talking about lifting big weights, or are we talking about something a little bit different?
Well, strength is important. You need, and I think we've talked about, maybe last week we touched on this, but let's use this analogy to try to quickly answer the question. Arm speed is important. Coaches talk about, I need a kid to hit a heavy ball, a hard ball, right? Well, and they also say you got to have arm speed, right? The faster the arm moves, more likely the harder you're going to hit the ball, the more kills you're going to get. So we test arm speed, right? The problem is, the analogy we'll use is, let's take a feather. If I take a feather, I can move that feather really fast. But if that feather contacts something of any mass, right, like a volleyball, that feather is going to break. So I could take an arm, and even with good mechanics, you can increase the speed of the movement of the arm. But if you don't create strength in the muscles that are going to generate the force, and maybe more importantly, tolerate the forces, and we talk about stability, right? That's a term we use, control of the shoulder joint. All the muscles on the front side, back side, top and bottom, that's the rotator cuff, but then all the other muscles there need to be trained and conditioned to control and tolerate the arm speed. So if we could take a feather and move it fast, but give that feather more structure, more size, then that feather is going to move faster. If we can take the arm and build the strength of the specific muscles around the arm, the shoulder joint, now we can move the arm fast. And when the hand contacts the ball, like you talked about earlier, thousands and thousands of time, more strength, more stability is going to allow the arm and shoulder to tolerate that. If that makes sense.
Yeah. That's awesome stuff, you guys. Really valuable information for athletes, coaches, and parents, all of the above, to hear. I want to kind of shift the conversation now from shoulder to knees. So I think we see a lot of shoulder pain. We see a lot of athletes complaining about shoulders. But I think we also see a lot of athletes complaining about pain. I mean, we even had one comment on this podcast. Chloe, I don't know if you're still watching, but we are going to get into knee pain now. So I want to kind of do the same structure of what we did with the shoulder, of how does it get created? What's the soreness versus pain? And then how to maybe avoid knee injury, more serious knee injury, so if you can. So let's dive in first. Kelly, could you tell us some of the different ways that you can get knee injury from, or knee soreness, pain, injury in volleyball?
Well, first of all, volleyball is high jumping sport, right? We're jumping, especially if you play front row. Middles, outsides jump the most, so they tend to have the most issues. One of the most common chronic knee issues with volleyball is patellar tendonitis or patellar tendinopathy. That's the jumper's knee, right? And it's about 40% of all female volleyball players, high school age especially, end up with jumper's knee at some point in their high school season, which is, to me, dumbfounding, right? That's a more chronic issue that is created, some by mechanics, some by landing on one leg constantly versus landing on 2 feet when they approach and swing and land, when they're moving side to side with blocking. And a lot of that comes from overuse again, but also lack of really good stability, ability to change direction well, having their body be able to stabilize to move again, create a really solid landing that puts a lot of stress on that patellar tendon. Another injury that's pretty common, and it's higher in female athletes than male athletes across the board, is ACL injury. ACL injury is a more traumatic injury. It's usually upon a single moment event, typically. And a lot of that has to do with the way they land. Okay, if an attacker is coming at the net, they tend to land awkwardly on one leg, and that puts a ton of mechanical stress and torque on the knee when they land. And then the other is landing a little awkwardly, even on 2 feet, whether those knees come together too much or they go under the net and they're trying to keep themselves off the net, that landing puts them at a high risk for ACL injury.
Yeah, lots to unpack there. I think I feel like knees might be one of the hardest things to figure out pain-wise, unless you're having a traumatic injury. Like, I feel like you usually know that, but pain-wise, how can you help that pain and how can you solve the soreness versus pain kind of deal there? So maybe we dive into what is the difference between maybe some knee soreness and knee pain. Billy, if you also want to add to this as well, please. Yeah.
Yeah, I think let's let Kelly roll with this. To me, it's going to come back, as you were just saying, that it's the fix on a lot of this is, once again, mechanics, strength, and stability. But I'm going to let Kelly roll. So
for sure. I think when you talk about soreness and pain, it's the same across the board, whether we're talking about the shoulder, the back, the knee, the ankle. If you are muscle soreness is normal after any sort of working out that you don't normally do, or an increase volume, like a tournament, you're increasing your jumping volume, you're decreasing your sleep, your overall expenditure of energy is much higher over a 3-day period, you're going to have soreness. That's normal. Soreness really you shouldn't be feeling when you're not moving, right? If I'm just sitting here and I have knee pain, like the area in front of my knee, that jumper's knee area, if it's hurting just sitting here, if it's hurting to do just regular activities, going up and down the stairs, that is not normal. That's pain. Pain happens. It can be sharp upon movement. It can be a deep aching sensation. It can be like neurological numbness, tingling sensation. Those feelings that you get in your body are not normal. And so soreness is okay. It lasts for a couple days, it goes away. Pain is something that chronically revisits you or stays with you while you're playing, after you're playing, 2 days later, you go back to practice and you try to jump serve and you have that knee pain again. That's a problem. By the time you go back to practice, all of your kind of weekend sorenesses should have been worn off and you should be able to get back to competition without a problem.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes sense. I kind of want to dive into now the mechanics side of how to maybe help, if you can, knee injury or pain, soreness, kind of all of the above, what needs to be done or what ways do players need to hit in order to best achieve, hopefully, knee painlessness, if that's a word.
Well, PowerCore 360's mechanics, the way that they teach the full approach, the positioning before you jump into the air, opening yourself up, to your court, to the sideline, rotating your body, that actually improves all sorts of issues from a volleyball perspective that coaches are always trying to fix. Spacing, too tight to the net, landing on one leg, all of those things can be addressed by changing the way that they attack the ball. And I think Billy could really speak to that. Because I know that when you run clinics, Billy, you know, one of the main things that we look at is if athletes are landing on one foot, you know, we're fixing it right now. And we can get the athletes to make a change on day one, right? So, Billy, speak to that.
Well, I think, sure. The short answer is, if they can turn their body, right, that creates more power. It's not just the feather swing, but you're using all the muscles from the body and the arm and shoulder, the feather, if you would. They're going to hit the ball harder. So that's the performance side. That's what, you know, every athlete, every coach wants. They want more kills. That's the way you score. You win matches. That's how everybody has success. The other side is that everything we tend to do, as you know very well, is we do performance and injury prevention at the same time. We don't go over and say, well, we're going to go over here and train with Kelly, the PT, and do injury prevention stuff, and then we're going to go work with Billy on the performance stuff. Everything we do is integrated, right? If you can turn your body, you're going to hit the ball harder. If you can turn your body, you have a better chance of learning and training your body to land on 2 feet. Landing on 2 feet probably cuts down the risk for an ACL or a meniscus injury by 80-90%. I'm just pulling that number out of the sky, but it's dramatic, right?
Sure.
But coaches need to understand, because sometimes, obviously, athletes come to our clinic, they go back, and the coach is like, you've got them, a left side hitter who's right-handed, you've got them landing facing the left antenna. And they're like, what are you doing? The game's over here. Well, we're teaching them, if they've completely rotated, we know they've generated rotational power, they're going to get more arm speed, ball speed, kills, and points. They're also now going to be able to turn their body and land in a position where their ankles, knees, hips are bent. We're going to take a lot of the stress off the knee, off the meniscus, off the ACL, the other structures there. So there you are. It's performance and injury prevention at the same time, if you've designed things and you're training things the same way. I'll say one other thing and then take a breath. There are kids, and it's going to happen. There's going to be a tight set. There's going to be a bad set. A kid's going to come down on one leg. And so all the years we've trained athletes and worked with clubs to do that, yeah, we're trying to eliminate the single leg landing, but the reality is it's going to happen. So we train athletes starting at the early part of the year to land on one foot. And maybe Kelly, you can speak to what are the muscles really involved? Everybody would probably go right to the knee and say, well, if she's having knee pain or he's having knee pain, let's just go strengthen the quads or the hamstrings as they control the knee. And you can speak to what muscles are probably as or maybe much more important than that. But in fact, let's just segue there. If you can speak to how do you stabilize the knee, what exercises or what muscles do you train?
Well, especially for sports performance, there's a lot of stop and go, change direction, lateral movements, landing sometimes on one foot. And the main stabilizers of your knee, yet the quad generates force, the hamstring generates force. It actually helps the ACL, right? It stabilizes. It's a supporter of the ACL. But really, the hip musculature and core, and when we talk about core, we're talking pubic bone to collarbone all the way around, right? That's 360 all the way around. That is really what creates stabilization, so that when you do land and you have those forces going through your knee, all of those muscles contract to stabilize that knee joint. The other thing is foot and ankle strength, and the ability of the foot and ankle to respond to its position on the ground is huge as well. But creating that ability to rapidly, and I mean, when I jump to the right and I land on my right foot, my body lands and stops on a dime. That ability to handle what I would call perturbation, right? That like perturbation is if you're stepping off a curb on a street and you step wrong and your body does one of these and your body pulls it all back together. That's rapid stability. Athletes have to have that at such a higher level. And if you don't train that, you can do all the heel taps, and you can do all of the knee extensions that you want to do on your machines. And that's not going to create rapid stability for the knee. It's mostly upwards of the knee and the hips. And I think core stability is huge. If you don't have control over your body, you don't have control over your extremities.
So to that point, I mean, and this gets a little into the weeds, but I'll get in and get out pretty quickly. What Kelly's talking about is it's a lot of people might be shocked. It's not getting in the squat rack, not do leg extension, leg curl, That all will strengthen muscles for sure, but it's very focused work on the musculature around the hip, the core, the abdominal muscles, the ankle, and the foot, above and below the knee joint that actually gives control, stability to the knee. And so, you know, going back to what I was talking about a few minutes ago is we would start a year off when I was working with the clubs or then now in our vertical jump program to train athletes the first month to be able to generate some strength and stability and be able to control the knee based on the musculature of the core, the hip, and the foot and the ankle. So that's really key. And I'm just going to give you an example. You said perturbation. I happen to have this rubber thing on my desk, and this is perturbation. It's vibration. And so even though your knee, you're not seeing anything move like that when you hit, there's that kind of stuff going on. And Kelly, maybe speak to the difference between, this is really in the weeds, but let's hit it quickly, the importance of training stabilizers in the hips and the ankle, the foot and the core, and not so much doing abdominal crunches and the quads and the big muscles. How does stability help this stop that vibration and control that in the ankle, knee, hip, spine, wherever?
Well, your stability muscles are typically your smaller muscle groups that lend a ton of support to the joints and to the ligaments and structures of the joints. Your big muscles are your gross movers. They're the ones that create that big gross movement that your, you know, your approach is a big gross movement. But when we want stability, if you don't have your joints being held together, if you will, by structures other than your ligaments, then the gross movers, as they move you through space, can't really control your limbs the way that your stabilizers do. I'm kind of like having a hard time like getting a handle on the easiest like layman's way to describe that. But a plank, which is sort of people do it thinking it's a stabilizing exercise, right? Because I'm working everything as hard as I can, but you're not moving your body, right? So you've got your big muscles firing, you got your little muscles firing, but there's no movement. Your gross muscles take you through big space. Your small muscles hold your body together, I guess is like the easiest way that I would.
So how about this? In a very practical sense, I guess the point we want to make sure we express is, as a strength coach, as a physical therapist, if we go train an athlete, we're not worried about putting them in a squat rack and getting big heavy weights on their back, their shoulders, anything else. That's going to train the big muscles. And those are important, but probably later. We start with the stabilizers first. With vertical jump, if we're trying to protect the knees or jump higher, we're going to teach those small little muscles doing exercises that aren't traditional exercises, right? But they teach rapid stability of the foot, the ankle, the hip, the spine. The athlete's going to actually, when they go to jump, if they're block jumping, their middle, they're going to block out to the left pin. Their feet hit. If their feet, ankle, knees, hips, and spine can contract quickly, those small muscles, that athlete's going up fast and has a good chance of blocking that ball, right?
Yeah.
If they don't, you see the athlete who's real slow moving right to left. Maybe their big muscles aren't that strong, but maybe what's also going on is whoever's training them is just worried about the big muscles, the quads, the hips, the back muscles, biceps, triceps. We're in the muscles nobody even knows about. That's where we start, right?
Right.
We train those first. We build a foundation there, like building the foundation of the house first before you start erecting walls. We train the stabilizers of the shoulder, the spine, the hips, the knee, the ankle, and then we start training the big guns once the athlete has control of their body.
For sure. I've worked with many of an athlete that comes in and they look really strong physically, but with some simple, more sports performance movements, you know, lateral bounds, forward bounds, even heck, holding their hands overhead and doing a full squat to the floor. They have no control over their body. Those big muscles really aren't serving them from a performance standpoint at that point because they really don't have control over them. So, yeah.
Yeah, I kind of want to cut this conversation here because I have a bunch of social questions that I want to end this episode with that we received from Instagram this week. So if you're listening, every single week before the podcast goes up, I'll make sure to put on our Instagram and Facebook stories questions that you guys want to ask us for the Volley Talk episode, and we will do our best to answer those questions and get to all of your questions. So some questions we have this week are pretty interesting. First one is, what should you do for shoulder mobility / shoulder warm-up for games and training?
Billy,
you want to get that one?
Yeah, I mean, it's we can both answer very easily. You know, you want some warm up. You want 4 or 5 minutes, common thing. You want the arm to move. No passive stretching. We're not pulling our arm across and holding it. We're dynamically activating the muscles around the shoulder blade, the spine, the arm. We want all those muscles on, right? The worst thing an athlete can do is go out and do passive stretches. That shuts the muscles down. Yeah, they're loose, but there's no control. Now the arm goes up in the air and we've got injuries because we don't have the muscles active. So we want an active dynamic warm-up, 4, 5, 6 minutes. You can do arm circles, you can do bands. There's a million things you could do, but we want it to be active, right? That's the short answer, not passive stretches, holding and breathing. That's after your workout, after your training. When you want to shut it down, you can go home and rest.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to plug PowerCore 360 quick with the gear that we sell as well, that are part of our clinics, our masterclasses, and you can just purchase too if you want. But Billy, I'm sure you can speak to this, but I would be positive that you could use some of that gear to help your muscles before practice and warm up and everything like that.
Well, for sure. I mean, and quickly, without really plugging it, the full body system has 2 arm cuffs. So, and bands that are going to be appropriate for rotator cuff, shoulder arm activation, right? Strengthening throughout the week, but before in a match, before a practice, to turn the right muscles on, including not only the rotator cuff, but the muscles under the shoulder blade to get the shoulder blade, the scap moving. Those are appropriate. And then also activation. Don't just think of it as an arm swing. Man, we got to get the hips moving, the spine moving, and the shoulders moving in this plane. That's where the torso harnesses, the hip harnesses, that equipment comes in. Once again, from a strength perspective, 3 times a week. But in this case, activation, get light bands, spend 4 or 5 minutes in the system. And it's a highly specific warm up for the shoulder, the spine, the core, the hips, the pelvis. Those muscles will actually be turned on for 20 or 30 minutes when you go into practice, go into a game. The arm's going to move faster. There's control. Those small stabilizers we were talking about are on, and they're actually creating performance, more speed, and they're controlling the arm, the shoulder, the spine, the hip and pelvis. So we're getting performance and also reducing injury risk at the same time.
Yeah. And one last social question that we received quite a few this week, but I just pulled 2 that maybe more relate to this topic. So I know we talked about knees, but what about, I relate to this as somebody who had very bad loosey-goosey hips throughout college, and ended up having hip surgery. So people are asking, should you be doing hip exercises before practice? If so, what does that look like? If we can maybe expand on that.
Sure.
Same thing, activation, right? You're not looking to stretch or elongate your muscles in a prolonged stretch prior to going into any athletic performance. Even if you were just going to go running, you don't want to do prolonged stretching. You want to activate those muscles around the hips to better support that hip joint and allow you to move through bigger ranges of motion because the muscles are active. Most people think that they're tight. And at the end of the day, as a PT, like, people come in and they're always, oh, my hip flexors are tight. My hip flexors are tight. They might be a little shortened and feel tight, but really what's happening is they're not stable. They're not strong. And so if you activate those muscles, you actually gain mobility right after activation. You gain mobility and stability. So, you know, I ran a club for quite a while and did athletic development injury prevention. And we focused on stability first, activating the kids' muscles before they went into practice. And you can do the same thing for your hips that you do for any other part of your body. It's not different.
Yeah. One question we just got from Instagram is, I think they meant my volleyball club does plyos before practice. And is that a good thing?
It's good from one perspective. It's good that when you're doing plyometrics, you're trying to train the nervous system, right? The brain, the nerves that control the muscles, right? That should be done in a fresh state, non-fatigue state. So from that perspective, you don't want to do plyos at the end of the day because, one, you're not going to get the reaction, vertical jump, a faster arm speed, whatever you're trying to work on. The response of the body isn't going to be as great. And then your risk, like a lot of injuries happen with fatigue. So if you did plyometrics after practice, after a match, after weightlifting, that fatigue state, you're not going to get very much. You're not going to get as much benefit from the plyometrics, and your risk of injury probably goes up. It's probably not recommended then. I mean, I guess you really have to determine. If I had to choose one or the other, I'd say, yeah, do your plyos before practice. Depends on what you're doing with practice. I wouldn't do it before a match because now you're going to go into the match, and if you're fatigued there, you know, you shouldn't be training before you go into a competition event. But in the perfect world, yeah, you probably don't want to be doing either of those back to back. That's part of the issue now with volleyball, especially club volleyball. Kids have to get better at some point in time. They actually have to train, and parents know, and athletes know, they got to have strength, they got to have speed, they got to have vert, they got to have power, they got to have all this stuff. It's a lot for a young athlete to get done, and so they're limited because of school, right? Unlike a college athlete where you can train at 6:30 in the morning or have practice at 11 a.m., we've got this small window for club or high school volleyball athletes to train. So sometimes it's you just got to get it done as you can get it done. In that case, I'd rather see them doing the plyos before practice rather than afterwards.
And I think I agree with you, Billy. And the one thing that I think is really important, and from a PT perspective, let's say you did have a challenging plyo workout, and then you go into practice and you're doing a ton of swinging. You know, it happens, right? You're going into a match 3 days out. They want to increase your reps and swinging to get, you know, whatever, timing with setters, whatever they're working on. I think it's super important as an athlete to recognize when you're tired, right? Like if you're going up and you just don't feel like you can get off the ground anymore, or when you land, you just don't feel like you have control over your body because you're just fatigued. That's when you raise your hand up and you talk to your coach, and hopefully, you know, they are willing to hear you say, dude, I am just exhausted. I don't feel like I can land. Look, whatever is going on, I think athletes need to learn to recognize when they're fatigued and don't push yourself that one more rep, right? And they can't help it. The time limits are so tight for when they can train. Typically it's before or after a practice, right? Versus going another day to do training at their club. But you just have to recognize your own body and when it's time to be done with a certain activity. That's just super important.
Yeah. Some great topics covered today, lots on injury. So thank you everybody who has listened in. Again, we are going to be doing this podcast/live stream every single Wednesday. Hopefully every single Wednesday. I think we have 1 week where it'll be on a Thursday, but we will make sure to let you guys know. Every single Wednesday at 4 p.m. Mountain Time to dive into all different things volleyball. So if you have any questions about volleyball, if you have any questions about injuries, if you have any questions or topics that you want us to dive into, feel free to comment on our YouTube, Facebook, or Instagram, or you can even send us a message, DM, and we will be sure to add those into the rotation for the topics we will be talking about. So thank you guys again for watching today. Everybody who joined, you guys were awesome. You had some great questions today, and we're looking forward to diving in with you guys on episode 3 next week at 4 p.m. Mountain Time, Wednesday. So thank you, Kelly, for being here today, and thank you, Billy, for being here always as the co-host of this podcast for Volley Talk, and it was a great conversation with you guys.